Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Bonkers Bearbock issues the most obscene, offensive publication ever seen in Berlin since 1945. The Pope tells Zelensky, hoist the white flag and sue for peace with Russia. Joe Biden wants to build a pier. May take a few months before we can land any significant aid into Gaza. I wonder what he meant by that. And 40 years on, Arthur Scargill is still the main man at the anniversary commemoration in Doncaster yesterday, where hundreds of people queued outside the venue to hear the master, the working class hero of all time, tell how the miners marched into history and joined the pantheon of people's heroes all over the world. Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night because this is the mother of all talk shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Bonkers Bearbock, the unhinged green foreign minister of the ailing Federal Republic of Germany, actually issued a Ramadan message this evening in which she said that she was heartfelt, sending a signal to all those in Gaza suffering from Hamas terrorism. It is unbelievable the tone deafness of these Western politicians. They imagine that the 112,000 people who are either dead, maimed, mutilated, or buried under the rubble inside Gaza are the victims of Hamas rather than the victims of their ally, Israel, with their full support, economic support, political support, cultural support in the Eurovision Song Contest, military support with weapons and intelligence overflights and all the rest. They really seem to believe that anybody in the entire Muslim world wants to hear a Ramadan message from the foreign minister of Germany blaming Hamas for 112,000 murdered and mutilated Muslim people. I'll tell you what, Germany, get rid of this woman. She's making your country a laughing stock as well as an economic basket case. Germany, the powerhouse of Europe, is now the sick man of Europe as a result of following the orders of senile butcher genocide Joe Biden, to whom I now turn. Joe Biden, who could with a single phone call tell Israel to open the gates and allow thousands upon thousands of fully laden trucks full of aid, some of it now spoiling. It's been standing out in the Sinai Desert for so long. He could phone Netanyahu and tell him, open the gates or there won't be another dollar. There won't be another dime. There won't be another bomb, another gun, another shell, another air force, another piece of diplomatic maneuvering on your behalf in the United Nations. Open the gates now. No, Joe Biden thinks that anyone's going to buy his solution, that 1,000 American soldiers go to the Gaza Strip. What could possibly go wrong, Joe? What could possibly happen to your 1,000 soldiers? If the Israelis don't kill them, the Palestinian resistance will kill them. 1,000 American soldiers to the Gaza Strip, a raging war zone, to do what? To build a harbour, which will take 6 to 8 weeks, they say. so that they could sail aid directly into the Gaza Strip. Why didn't anybody think of that? It could have been done any day, sending barges from the ships onto the beach. We don't need a harbour. And anyway, maybe you've got an ulterior motive for your harbour, Genocide Joe. Maybe you want to build that harbour so you can steal the oil and gas in the sea off Gaza, which belongs to the Palestinian Authority. Maybe you want to do in Gaza what you are already doing in Syria, in the parts of Syria that you remain in illegal occupation of, looting them of their oil in great profusion. The Pope has told Zelensky it's time to hoist the white flag. Cue outrage amongst the NAFO brigade all over the world. But what His Holiness is saying is enough is enough. Ukraine has lost this war. Hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives in this war. Hundreds of billions of euros and dollars have been wasted on this war. And the only result of continuing to fight it is that more and more Ukrainian territory will be lost. More and more millions of Ukrainian citizens will fly to other countries as refugees and settle there. Not much liked, they will come to be amongst the public that they have been dropped in amongst. Trust me on that. And remember, you heard it here. All the Pope is saying is enough is enough. Who will doubt it? Who's going to call for the continuation of the fight to the last drop of Ukrainian blood? Has enough Ukrainian blood not already been shed in a losing cause, in a war that need never have happened, should never have happened, in a war that was provoked not by the Ukrainians themselves, but by their NATO masters? Washington declared the war over the dead bodies of Ukrainians, a proxy war against Russia, and they were open about their war aims. They wanted to regime change Moscow. They wanted to break Russia up into what they call its constituent parts. Not one Russia, but a balkanized Russia. Dozens of Russias. Little statelets that they could maneuver and conspire within, turning one against the other, having all build a state, an army, an air force, having all build all the paraphernalia of antagonistic states. They didn't hide it. That was their intention. And the fact that they didn't hide it is the principal reason why Russia has prevailed. If you tell a country that you intend to break it up, that you intend to pick its government, that you intend to redraw its borders, that you intend to feast upon the dripping roast of its economy, what can that country do but fight back? They underestimated Russia. They underestimated President Putin. They underestimated, above all, the Russian national unity that has now prevailed to the extent that the Pope is calling for Zelensky to hoist the white flag. I've never seen such a tidal wave of anti-Catholic guff in my life on social media as that has followed His Holiness's call today. Maybe he could have put it better. Maybe he could have avoided the allusion of the white flag, but the essence of his message is surely clear and unanswerable. The longer this is stalled, the worse will be the outcome for the remaining rump Ukrainian state. Meanwhile, little Macron threatened Russia this week that an advance on Kiev or Odessa would bring French troops into the war. Well, I thought he was a historian, Macron, but he obviously has forgotten what happened the last time French forces poured into and across the Russian steppe. Napoleon beat his retreat from Moscow, a bedraggled and defeated figure. The idea that the French society, riven from head to foot, most of them, 75% of them, against their pretender, their Dauphin, little Macron, are going to fight Russia for Ukraine, for Odessa, was always a non-starter. And quickly, the French armed forces made it clear that no such thing would be happening. But the fact that these raving fantasists in the chanceries of Europe, in the presidencies, in the prime ministerships of Europe, are still entertaining in the face of all the facts that they can intervene in this proxy war directly and not suffer a total defeat. I've only got one word to say to you, and that is Oppenheimer. Take it in. Hear what I'm saying. By definition, if Russia is facing an existential threat, it will use every weapon in its armory. And if there are no red lines for Macron, there will be no red lines for Moscow. It's obvious. Oppenheimer's going to win all the Oscars. Quite right. Great film. But nobody seems to have calculated that the nuclear weapons Russia would land on Paris are 1,000 times more powerful than that monstrosity you see on the screen behind me that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You want that? You want some, Mr. Macron? Well, the French people don't, and they need to rise up and tell their president so. The rest of the leaders in Europe, Schultz, who's committed acts of self-harm against his own people, against his own economy. Macron and little Rishi Sunak, about whom more later, who couldn't fight his way out of a wet paper bag, who's never heard a gun fired in anger, unless on the grouse moors, if they allow people like him to come hunting with them on the grouse moors. Somebody'd ask him for a gin and tonic. Trust me on that. Little Rishi Sunak. Little Grant Shapps or Grant Green or whatever he's calling himself today amongst his multiple aliases. Britain is a country whose flagship aircraft carrier caught fire again this weekend. That has a fleet of warships that crash into each other in the Solent. That can't join the war games for NATO. That can't send their commitment to the Red Sea, because their ships ain't up to it. Britain's a country with an army that could fit into Villa Park, the home of Aston Villa, where they got humped by Tottenham Hotspur today. These fantasists, these gnats, these fleas threatening an elephant, of course, are only doing what Mussolini did. It was said of Mussolini that he went around the world threatening people with Germany's army. That's what little Grant Green is doing. It's what little Macron is doing. It's what little soldier Schultz is doing. They're threatening people with America's army. But the Americans don't want war either. That's the meaning of the virtually total collapse of the presidency of genocide Joe Biden, who, quite apart from all his other failings, which include, of course, his failings of actual cognition, of actually knowing where he is, what year it is, what flavor of ice cream he is eating, where the toilet is, and why you should go to it when you need, rather than after you've done it in your pants. This man is the leader to whom Macron, Schultz, Sunak are bowing and scraping when he's not fit to be sent out for a loaf from the eventide home that he should be spending these last years in the twilight of his life in. And the American people ain't wearing it. Joe Biden's ratings have fallen to the lowest ever recorded by any president in office seeking re-election in all history. And his opponent is half mad himself, Donald Trump. I mean, it's not as if he's facing some insurgent Bill Clinton or Jack Kennedy. He's facing Donald Trump, and he's facing the mother of all humiliating defeats. Unless, of course, they arrest Donald Trump before he gets to the starting gate. Unless, God forbid, they kill Donald Trump before he gets to the starting gate. The Democrats made a very big mistake in not moving Joe Biden out and bringing some kind of substitute other than Kamala, laughing gas, Harris in his place. Finally, I spent Saturday afternoon in what, for me, is a kind of heaven. I have been an honorary member of the National Union of Mine Workers since 1982. That's a long time ago. 2 years after I became a member of the union, the epic, historic struggle between the miners and the Thatcher government began in 1984, exactly 40 years ago this month. I went to Doncaster. I went to the Hatfield Main Colliery. I went to the miners' club there. I joined the march with brass bands and bagpipe bands led by a Scotsman from Fife who left 61 years ago and still sounds exactly like a fifer. Many Scottish miners moved to the Yorkshire coalfield when their own pits closed for economic reasons in the 1960s. When I got into the club, just ahead of the leader, Arthur Scargill, there was prolonged and entirely spontaneous cheering and applause. Not because I fought every day of that strike. Many of the people there are soldiers and of that dispute, of course, but most of them are daughters and sons of the miners that fought that dispute. They weren't cheering me because of my role in the miners' union, my support for their struggle from the first day until the last day and until now. They were cheering me because I had soundly thrashed the so-called Labour Party and the Conservative Party in the by-election here in Rochdale. They were cheering because they live in complete despair of Britain's political class. I'll be making my maiden speech on Tuesday. I'll be drawing on some of the things that Arthur Scargill said in his speech on Saturday about how our country has been systematically destroyed by our own ruling political and economic class. How our country has been de-industrialized, dis-industrialized, just like Germany is undergoing now. Before we entered that strike in 1982, we had a coal industry, 1,000 years of coal underneath our feet. We had a steel industry. We had a car industry, a truck industry, a railway workshops industry, a motorbike industry. Our hammers flew, the sparks showered. We were a power still in the world, and it has all been destroyed in the interests of globalized capitalism, in the interests of finance capital. Everything that happens in this country happens for the people with money, happens for the city of London. I'll be giving my speech on Tuesday in the budget debate. Look out for it. I'll be naming names. I'll be seeking to shame the guilty men and some women who are responsible for Britain's plight. I spoke to a man at my son's football today. My son won man of the match, incidentally. I spoke to a man sitting on the bench watching the kids playing football today. He said to me, tell them something. Tell them that we once had a country. Tell them that we once had a community. We once had a society. We once had things that were great. And now the country is a shithole and the political class are responsible for it. It's going to be the mother of all talk shows.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, Rania Kalec, one of my favorite journalists and broadcasters. She's the host of Dispatches on Breakthrough News. And we're very lucky that tonight she's on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Rania, welcome back to the show. It's been some time. Wonderful to see you again. What did you think of Joe Biden's idea to build a pier in Gaza? Is he up to something or is this just a piece of madness?
It's absolutely a piece of madness, George. But before I say what I think about that, I want to congratulate you on your win. I think it's not just a win for you, George, but I think it's a win for Palestine in so many ways. And about the pier, this is theatrics. It's theatrics because there is a famine taking place in Gaza. Children are dying of starvation. We see the images. They're horrifying. They're reminiscent of images we recall from World War II during the Nazi Holocaust. And this is intentional. It's an intentional policy by the Israelis of starvation. They're not hiding it. They are openly celebrating it, both Israeli officials since this genocide began, as well as Israeli citizens who are standing at the border callously protesting the entrance of any aid because they are openly desiring the starvation of children in Gaza. And this is happening because the U.S. government is allowing it to. And this pier that Biden has announced that he wants to build, which is going to cost a lot of money, which requires sending something like thousands of U.S. troops to go to the coast of Gaza. One, it's going to take 30 days to set up. I mean, how many Palestinians are going to die of starvation in those 30 days. And on top of that, it is potentially placing some sort of military presence at the coast of Gaza, which hasn't really been discussed so much. But again, it's pure theatrics. All this requires to stop is a call from Joe Biden. He has, for 5 months now, entering the 6 months, refused to stop this genocide because he wholeheartedly agrees with it. And he wants it to continue. And I have nothing, I have no other, you know, there's nothing else to believe about Joe Biden's intentions besides that until he puts a stop to it. So this pier means nothing at all.
Now, he did say that there would be a ceasefire. Laughing Gas Harris said it would be a 6-week ceasefire before they began killing again for Ramadan. But Ramadan just began. There's no ceasefire. What's going on?
What's going on here is that they don't care for a ceasefire because they want a ceasefire on Israel's terms. They want complete surrender. They want all the hostages to be sent back without any conditions. And they're not going to get that, especially after everything they've done in Gaza. So at the end of the day, all this talk of a ceasefire is, again, theatrics, because the U.S. is refusing to place any pressure on the Israelis. And they don't even really want a ceasefire. They want a pause. That's it. They want to pause. So let's stop the genocide for a few weeks and then continue with it. This policy is so atrocious. And at this point, I mean, we can sit here and talk about the Israelis and their intentions. They have genocidal intentions. They're openly declaring it. They're openly celebrating it in very disturbing ways. But at the end of the day, again, this wouldn't be possible without the wholehearted, enthusiastic support of the Biden administration. They are, I mean, they've secretly approved 100 weapon sales to Israel that we just learned about, on top of all the open weapon sales that we know have been taking place, on top of the fact that they just keep sending any weapon Israel wants. They have all this leverage and they're unwilling to use it. So the question becomes, why? It's because they have a stake in this, George. They have a stake in this because at the end of the day, when we think about October 7th, and what took place that day, you had, as Joseph Borrell of the European Union would call it, you had the jungle people firing back at the garden. And that is completely unacceptable to the rulers of empire. And so this genocide is intended as a kind of punishment, as a sort of display of violence, to set a precedent for the rest of the global South, that if you dare to fire back at your plantation owners, at your imperial masters, this is what we will do to you. And that's exactly what's happening right now. And until they feel they've sufficiently punished the population of Gaza, they're not going to stop.
Now, you mentioned genocide. I distinctly remember the International Court of Justice, the highest court in the whole world, with the fanfare, at least in those countries that didn't suppress the news, like my own in Britain. They didn't even televise the findings of the ICJ. They plausibly, or rather, let me put it this way, they found Israel to plausibly be guilty of genocide and sent them for trial on that charge. And they gave them 4 weeks to respond to peremptory demands, which would have brought the slaughter in Gaza to a halt. Well, the slaughter did not halt. Indeed, it intensified. And I've heard nothing since from the International Court of Justice. Is this an example of the rules-based order they keep telling us about?
You know, it's so interesting, George. They've spent all these decades creating this, you know, U.S.-led rules-based order that they've really just, you know, weaponized against any country that dares to, you know, stand up and really pave a path in their own interests rather than U.S. interests. But they're willing to completely destroy it in the name of protecting Israel, in the name of protecting the sort of spear of imperialism for the West in the Middle East. And they've created a mockery of international humanitarian law, and they've really killed any pretense of the, you know, sort of freedom and democracy they claim to represent. And they've essentially killed these international institutions that they've created. You know, they've also killed the UN in so many ways. Look at how helpless all of these international institutions have proven themselves to be in the face of genocide. If ever there was a reason for some sort of humanitarian intervention to prevent a bunch of genocidal sociopaths from carrying out their plans, it's now. And every legal measure, as important as those measures are to try to utilize, has proven to be a failure in the short term, at least. And I think what that demonstrates is, yes, the end of the rules-based order, but also I think the importance of resistance in the region, George, because that is all that Palestinians have right now. All they have, all that's standing between them and complete and utter annihilation, is the various armed resistance movements across the countries in the region, from Yemen to Lebanon to the groups that are fighting for their own survival in Gaza.
Well, the fighting is going to continue. And by the way, if 1,000 American soldiers end up in Gaza, it will not be a comfortable billet for them. I am certain about that. So their mothers and sweethearts should know that 1,000 U.S. soldiers are being sent into real danger and jeopardy if that happens. We'll see if it does happen. But I've got a question more difficult. It's difficult for me to ask. It's difficult for you to answer. Why has nobody else decided that force majeure was required. We've had China declare over and over again that it is completely unacceptable. We've had Russia declare the same thing. We've had South Africa. We've had the global South declare it. We've had Indonesia, which has had a hospital ship off the coast of Gaza now for 5 months, but unable to land and bring aid to the people. Why don't countries like China, if I was running China, I would say, I'm sending in ships full of aid, and you, Mr. Netanyahu, can decide whether or not you're going to fire on me for doing that. Why has that not happened?
You know, George, I mean, I can't tell you what the Chinese are saying or what the Indonesians are saying or what the South Africans might be saying behind closed doors or really any country. But I would imagine that what we're seeing right now is a fear of the U.S. and Israel. I mean, the biggest armies in the world are the U.S., the European armies, and Israel's a very powerful army, and they have nuclear weapons. And it is a mad dog, you know. The Israeli leadership used to like to say we have to behave like a mad dog so the world is scared to mess with us. But I think they've actually reached the level where they are the mad dog, and it's frightening. We don't know what they're capable of doing. We see some of what they're capable of doing in Gaza. They are behaving completely irrationally and outrageously violently. And their parent, the U.S., is complicit in that mad dog behavior. And I think it demonstrates that as far as force goes, as far as power goes in terms of military power, the U.S. is still the hegemon in the world. And we see how far the U.S. is willing to go, not just when it comes to Israel. I mean, look at Ukraine. Look at how many weapons the U.S. has been willing to pour into Ukraine, risking a potential nuclear war, the use of nuclear weapons with Russia over trying to maintain control over Ukraine and keep Russia out of the European sphere. So I think that this is a fear, that countries are acting out of fear of the U.S. and Israel, and they can't guarantee, even the Chinese cannot guarantee, that if they send a ship to the coast of Gaza to try and force aid in, that the Israelis won't fire on them. And I think that speaks to the rogue nature of both Israel and the United States at this point in history, and it is terrifying. These countries are terrifying. People around the world should be scared of these countries. They are completely illegitimate at this point. And I think it demonstrates the need for U.S. empire to end, because this violence is the fallout of that empire. And I think in like a kind of microcosm way, the fact that Israel is really willing to take so much down with it, I mean, it's either we get to stay a settler colony or we will take everyone down with us. That's kind of the mentality they have. I think the U.S. has that mentality, but about the entire world. And it's frightening. It's a big question. I don't know the answer to how to deal with that, but it does point to a very dark future in many ways.
Now, what did you think of the Pope's call today on Zelensky to raise the white flag and sue for peace? It's got him on the Ukrainian death list, along with me and many others, maybe even including you. What did you make of what he said?
I'm sorry to smile. It's not a funny matter. It's just so outrageous. I don't know what else to do besides laugh a little bit. I mean, it's a bit late. We're 2 years into this war, and it should have ended a long, long time ago. But I think it speaks to the fanaticism on the side of the Ukrainians. I'm not sitting here saying Russia's perfect or so like angelic, but we know that on the Ukrainian side, the U.S. has been, and its European partners have been, arming and funding and encouraging far-right movements that are quite scary, quite nationalistic, and in some cases neo-Nazi. So it's not surprising at all that you would see anybody who supports an end to this war be put on some weird fascistic kill list by these people. It's very dangerous. And I think it just speaks to the kinds of forces that the so-called collective West represents around the world, whether we're talking about Ukraine, whether we're talking about the kinds of forces that they support against China, and whether we're talking about the very genocidal, fascistic, sociopathic society that is the country of Israel. These are the allies of the West, and they always have been around the world. And I think we're kind of reaching a peak here where it's just so cartoonish. Like, how much cartoonish does it get, George, than seeing the Pope be put on a Ukrainian kill list for calling for the end of a war? And it's kind of, you know, there's a sort of parallel to what you see the Israelis do. The Israelis, anybody who calls for a ceasefire is an anti-Semite. Anybody who's anti-genocide is now an anti-Semite. I mean, it's just so ridiculous and so outlandish. And the jokes kind of make themselves.
Yeah. How will all this play in November, Rania, in your view? Joe Biden is sowing death and destruction around the world, making the United States the most hated country in the world, alongside its mad dog, Israel. He's failed economically. He's failed to heal the wounds of America. Can he seriously be reelected at the age of 91 or whatever he is?
I mean, let's be realistic also. Joe Biden is clearly suffering from some sort of cognitive decline. It looks like elder abuse, honestly, when you see the videos of him coming out, though I don't feel bad for him because he's overseeing a genocide. All that said, you know, aside from the personality of Joe Biden, I think what this demonstrates is that we have a two-party dictatorship in the U.S. And it's very clear for everyone to see right now, the sort of vote blue no matter who Democrats who want to force us to vote Democrat. Otherwise, we'll have the horrible, horrible Republicans and the horrible, horrible Trump. I mean, I don't really know how to respond to them other than what's worse than genocide. You know, I'm not telling people to vote for Trump, but really, what's worse than genocide? Genocide is the worst case scenario to me. And Joe Biden has proven that Democrats actually are not a lesser evil. They are a part of the same disgusting, imperialist, parasitic system that creates genocides like what we're seeing in Gaza. What comes November? I think that we're going to see Joe Biden lose. If this continues, and even if it doesn't continue, I think at this point, people are so traumatized from seeing the, you know, dead babies on their social media feeds. And they blame Joe Biden for that, that even if there's a ceasefire tomorrow, there's a very good chance he'll lose because of the fact that Arab and Muslim voters matter and people who don't like genocide matter. And they're not going to vote for him. They've demonstrated their anger at him with these Democratic primaries, where in one state after another, from Michigan to Minnesota and onward, you've seen a significant number of people voting uncommitted to protest Joe Biden and in swing states like Michigan, where he needs those votes, but he doesn't seem to care. Joe Biden, interestingly enough, is placing his support for Israel's genocide in Gaza over his own ability to secure a second term. And when that happens, they're going to blame Arabs. They're going to blame Muslims and they're going to blame the left and probably Putin and Xi Jinping, like they always do. But we will know that these parties are not different. And this, if ever we've seen a moment in history when it is time to build something outside of this corrupt, dictatorial two-party system that puts a gun to our heads every 4 years and forces us to vote for different flavors of genocide, if ever there was a moment to prove we need to build something else, it is now. And I am seeing so much organizing happening on the ground in the U.S. to do just that. And that is what I'm encouraged and inspired by.
A very set of circumstances present here in this country, which resulted in my election in Rochdale last week. Rania Kalik, tell us finally, how do people see Breakthrough News? I'm sure many will want to do so now.
Well, thank you so much, George. People can follow Breakthrough News on YouTube and on all your social media platforms at BT Newsroom. I love the programming we're able to do. We're able to give a platform to lots of amazing people, hopefully soon you, George. And yes, please follow along. We're covering Gaza and much of the rest of the world all the time.
Lovely. Thank you. Wonderful to see you. I know that it's widely shared by the audience. I'm seeing it on my screen now. Thank you, Rania Kalik of Breakthrough News, for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Let me take a quick break, then I'll be right back.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, Tadhg Hickey is not just an Irish comedian, actor and writer. He's become a major player in the social media battles that have taken place over the last 5.5 months. He is absolutely indefatigable. He is so courageous that the enemies of truth and justice have already begun to retreat under fire from him. I'm a huge admirer of his work. He even had a Palestinian flag on the stage just the other night. I saw a picture moments ago. Tadhg, welcome back to the Mother of All Talk Shows. I asked you last time if this was harming your career in any way. Is it now seriously harming your career? And if it is, what does that say about Ireland today?
First of all, thanks for having me back and congratulations on your win. You're annoying all the right people.
Thank you.
I think, yeah, I mean, it's affected my career a little bit, but to be realistic about it, we're quite lucky in Ireland. Ireland is an outlier in Europe. As you know, I've got friends in Germany, I have friends in Britain, and I have friends in the US whose careers are destroyed by their pro-Palestine stance. It's not that extreme here, but there's subtle and not so subtle things I've noticed. Like a very small example is I used to pick up quite a lot of corporate work. I did voiceovers would have been one of my main sources of income for about the last 5 years. Since the outbreak of the so-called war on October 7th, I haven't had an audition. I haven't had an email. I haven't booked a gig. None of the corporates are reaching out to me anymore. So it feels to me like if you're anti-genocide, you're bad for business. That certainly seems to be the case. But I'm very lucky, George. I have built up a following from people around the world now. And it means a lot to me because, you know, the way in our part of the world, you're only a success if you've made it in Britain and the US. It's a completely Western colonial mentality. But I'm very proud to say that like most of my fan base and followers now are in the Middle East. And I love that. Or the Arab diaspora in Canada and the US. So I'm very lucky on Patreon. I've got a lot of followers who are helping me out. So, you know, yeah, my career has been damaged a little bit, but I think we're at a point where personally, I feel what's going on in Gaza right now is the situation is so grave. It's so extreme that if you're thinking about your career right now, I think you've kind of lost your moral compass. And I try not to be judgmental about other people, but I don't think it's a time to be thinking about your career. It's gone beyond a social media thing for me now because I have Palestinian friends in Cork, in Ireland, in Dublin and beyond Ireland, I should say. And they're every day waking up, checking their phones to see if members of their family have died from starvation, if they've been assassinated, if I'm going to show them solidarity, both as a friend and as somebody with some sort of influence online. I think I need to be loud and proud about my support for their cause and, more importantly, the end to this unspeakable genocide that's being live streamed in real time that everybody knows about. So my career is not that important to me right now.
Well, very, very well said, Tadhg, and many people will be applauding you literally as well as metaphorically right now. You've become a bit of a hero. What drew you into this? Did you pay a lot of attention to the issue for long, or was it the extreme nature of this post-October 7 genocide that has moved you to make it such a major part of your life?
I feel like, I mean, as we spoke about before, I'm very proudly an Irish Republican, and Irish Republicanism for me, my friends in the North and my friends in the South, it's always been an internationalist thing. You know, we've shown support as Irish Republicans for Cuba, for South Africa. I think that's the beauty of Irish Republicanism, and I think it's why it kind of has sustained itself in terms of a global appeal and understanding, because unlike loyalism, it isn't insular. It is internationalist. So I think I've always been aware of what's going on in Palestine. I've always felt strongly about it. I probably didn't have an opportunity to do that much about it with my own work until one of the last so-called wars on Gaza. I think it would have been 2021. I had started making sketch comedy on my own then, and I did some sketches that did like a lot of numbers. So I suppose I would have entered into the social media war, as you say, in that period. But it was also a period where I reached out to people in the Al-Aida camp and stuff, and I built relationships with Palestinians, which is the most important thing. Because, you know, to go back to that point again, where it's not just a kind of an abstract concept when you become friendly with people who are actually going through a genocide. It's an extraordinary thing. It's as close as I can imagine to being witness to the so-called famine in our country or during the conflict in the north, where you would actually be with people, you're going through it in real time. So when that happened, I think in 2021, I suppose I was drawn in and I became very passionate about it. And then in the outbreak post October 7th, as I say, it's gone on to a level where I actually didn't think it was possible for it to get to this level of murder and mayhem and organized mass starvation, and for the West not only to still be shrugging its shoulders and looking the other way, but to be aiding and abetting it and vocally supporting it. It's at a level where I feel like any reasonable person, Irish Republican or not, if you care about human beings, if you care about children, if you care about women, if you care about journalists, if you care about frontline workers, that you would just have to stop everything you're doing and go to that mentally and spiritually, you know, that you would just, everything that you could do would be with the people of Palestine right now. I don't understand how it's any other way. And I actually would love to use the opportunity to just say to people who have influence, particularly on Instagram and whatnot, if they haven't said something before, it's never too late to join the cause. I know Palestinians will be very grateful for you to do it. Nobody will be, where have you been? I don't think so anyway, and I'm obviously not going to speak for Palestinians, but we just need voices. We just need numbers. Like, please use your platform. You've got an opportunity to use your platform for the most extraordinary purpose you'll ever have the opportunity to do. Like, I urge people to do it. It's not too late.
Well, I won't hold my breath for Bono to join us on the international picket line, but it would be good if he did, even at this late stage. En passant, I should tell you that I met in the corridors of power this week Lord Taylor, John D. Taylor, the former Unionist MP, now peer, who I've travelled with in the Middle East and who is as strong a supporter of the Palestinians in Gaza as you or me. So it isn't all Unionists. It isn't all Loyalists.
100%.
And I was very grateful. He's an old man now, but he hobbled after me on his walking stick to congratulate me and to congratulate me not just on my election, but on the role I've been playing over the last 5.5 months to defend the poor people of Gaza. It's only right that I should say that. Now, you are an Irish Republican. As half an Irishman, so am I. How should we evaluate the Sinn Féin visit to the White House? I'm in a bind about it. I don't support Sinn Féin. I used to, but I don't now since they became a bit too Blairite for me. But I support their aim, and I know they're the only people who are going to bring that aim to fruition. So I don't want to attack them. I don't want to weaken them. But I find it very difficult to accept the argument that you should hand a shamrock to the blood-stained hand of Joe Biden. What do you stand on that?
I don't want to echo your sentiments too closely at the risk of just not having a very fruitful discussion or debate, but I feel very close to what you're saying. I mean, I would be, you know, I wear my heart on my sleeve. I would be traditionally a Sinn Féin supporter, or at least an Irish Republican. I would vote for the party in Ireland that I feel would be most likely to fulfill the dream of a united Ireland, being completely honest. That's what got me interested in politics. That's where I've come from. I have many friends in Sinn Féin, but I kind of feel like I'm not a member of the party. I probably should say that. I'm just a lowly comedian. I'm just a joker in the pack with an interest in politics. But I would say that if you want something to be better, you should be open in your assessment of it. And I think in this particular instance, Sinn Féin are making the wrong moral decision, I feel. And I think if you were to just be mercenary about it for a moment, I think it's potentially the wrong tactical decision as well. I mean, I know you speak about Labour and the Tories being two cheeks of the same arse. I mean, we have the original arse in Ireland, like the most long-running arse in kind of European politics in terms of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, literally carving up the state since its foundation and ruling it themselves in this kind of meandering morass of centre-right, so-called centre-left. And we have an opportunity for Sinn Féin to lead the first leftist government in the South ever, which is something that I probably would have dreamed of since I was in school. But I think the stance on Palestine, which offers a lot of significant substance, I would say that. And like you, I'm very eager not to be too critical of a party that is offering people like me and much younger than me an opportunity to get Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael out of government. Because in terms of housing, in terms of health, they have proved themselves inept and completely out of touch with the needs of ordinary people in Ireland. So I would love to see a leftist government in Ireland. That would be a dream. But Sinn Féin's young vote, I think, particularly, is not. It's actually quite tenuous, in my opinion. So I would traditionally vote for Sinn Féin because I'm an Irish Republican. A lot of young people are voting for Sinn Féin, in my opinion, in my experience, because they feel like they're going to deliver proper housing. They're going to sort out health. They're going to do the things that young people kind of care about. I think most young people that I'm meeting at marches anyway are so appalled by what's going on in Gaza and have Arab and Palestinian friends now in Ireland. The fact is that the Palestinians you speak to do not want Irish politicians from any party to go to the White House on Patrick's weekend. That is a fact. We don't expect any better from the government parties. I certainly wouldn't. They're always going to go on a jolly and, you know, respect their own corporatist interests in doing so. I think Palestinians expected more of Sinn Féin, and I still think it's not too late to do the right thing. I think that the party, I think, has said something like Palestinians will understand that we have to put our priorities first, when Irish unity is obviously the main priority of Sinn Féin. And going to Washington is traditionally a good thing to do, to pursue Irish unity. I'm talking to Palestinian friends here, and the fact is they don't understand. They don't understand. And to go back to what I said earlier about internationalism, solidarity with substance means that when your ally, when somebody, a similarly oppressed, colonized group of people who you have the solidarity and kinship with for a long, long time are in the situation that Palestinians are in right now, I feel like solidarity with substance means that you put your own private goals and desires to the side and you actually offer genuine fellowship to the oppressed. And I feel like it's going to be a moral and a tactical error.
Tadhg, you mentioned the corporate work has dried up. How can our audience support your work? How can they see you? Where do they find you?
I'm on all the usual old nonsense, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and TikTok and all that. And I have a Patreon account. If people don't like Patreon, there's a PayPal as well. But what I would say is, if you're finding it hard, because I think a lot of pro-Palestine people are being silenced right now, if you're finding it hard to share my stuff, I get a lot of messages from people saying, I can't share stuff, you're being shadow banned or blocked or whatever. Just share another pro-Palestine account. Just keep sharing and prioritize Palestinians. Because if we keep supporting each other, we can kind of create a stand and break through the tech fascism that's going on as well at the moment. So let's just stick with each other and not get too bogged down on prioritizing one or two people. We're a tribe. So thank you. And thanks, George, for your time.
You're quite a man, Tadhg. Thank you very much indeed for joining us again on the Mother of All Talk Shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
On the line in Los Angeles is Nick to talk about Biden and the Pope. Co-religionists, of course, Joe. Nick, apparently.
Apparently, George. And once again, as everybody said, congratulations. From here, we've watched your campaign and your success and the mainstream media in the UK completely freaking out as your voice is now growing stronger and stronger. So congratulations. God bless you.
Well, I'll tell you what, before you go on, Nick, I had to go for my wife. I don't eat burgers. I had to go for my wife to buy a Smashies burger in Rochdale right before the show. They're great burgers, by the way. Smashies. Look them up. I bought her a burger, and when I went in, there was a young fellow sat there waiting for his order. He said, "George, man, they're out to get you with pitchforks." That's what it has been like in the mainstream media, as it's called, although they don't get enough audience nowadays, truly, to be so described. Sorry, Nick, go ahead.
No, and on that note, George, I follow you somewhat religiously. So I'm following all these attacks that and the conversations that are going on throughout the YouTube community, especially from maybe LBC commentators, Nick Ferrari and the gang and others, Peter Hitchens, and, you know, the list is endless. So I'm continually fronting them or confronting them on your behalf, as thousands and thousands of people are. So it's working. And please God, it will continue to move forward. It seems as though it will. The people are ready for it. But going back to our friend Genocide Joe, and as an East End, even though I ran away from Thatcher's Britain in 89 to Los Angeles because I used to be in the entertainment business, and I think once upon a time you may have been even discussed a show that I used to be on because it had a little controversy in the late 80s, and you were probably in Parliament at the time because it upset Margaret Thatcher. But so I ran away from Thatcher's Britain.
Okay.
And as an East End Catholic originally, I've always been schooled and was always impressed upon me by my parents and family that justice and standing up for those that couldn't stand up for themselves was a core trait of Catholics, working class Catholics. And what we see in America, predominantly, and I come from an Irish-Italian background, it's very prevalent and common theme with those that seem to think that they're Irish Americans and so have an affinity or a connection to the Catholic Church, that they seem to be the biggest bigots and the worst of all in America, from my perspective as an East End Catholic from the UK. And we've got one in the White House. And so the question, obviously the million-dollar question is, and it sort of also it reminds me of a very famous Question Time, maybe your last Question Time appearance, when you were attacked in Finchley by a bunch of young Zionists, but there happened to be to your right a lady who professed to be a Catholic. And I always remember you said, "Please don't touch me," when you were being attacked in that studio, that BBC studio. But when is the Pope going to come forward and call out Genocide Joe? Because isn't he up for to be held accountable?
Especially as Genocide Joe pooped his pants in front of the Pope. In what was described as a wardrobe incident. I mean, what could be more insulting to His Holiness? Joe Biden's a Catholic in the way that Tony Blair is a Catholic. A Catholic that believes in slaughtering the innocents. A Catholic who offends Catholic doctrine from A to Z, from abortion to... I'm not smart enough to come up with a Z just like that. The idea that these people are Catholics is monstrous. Monstrous. What would Jesus say? What would St. Peter say about what they do, what they support, what they fund, what they vote for, what they conceal, what they cover up? What kind of a Catholic is Joe Biden or Tony Blair? They're a disgrace. They bring disgrace on the Roman Catholic Church. And it's a shame that the hierarchy can't bring themselves openly to say so. Nick, a beautiful call. You've got me intrigued about that series you worked on. Hey, we got to 50,000 votes on the poll. Should Israel be banned from the Eurovision Song Contest? 50,542 votes were cast. And overwhelmingly, people voted for a ban on Israel from the Eurovision Song Contest. Now, if journalism existed in Britain, that would be a newsworthy poll. That is the biggest poll on this subject by a country mile that anyone has ever conducted. And the results are utterly overwhelming. Let's take a legend. Last call. It's Norma in Bristol. Norma, happy Mother's Day to you, my dear.
Oh, thank you, George. It was my birthday last Monday, so I had a very happy birthday instead. I had all my
Excellent.
Friends then.
Very good.
So I didn't have much today. No, the thing I'm trying to say is, last week, and I wanted to ask you last week, there was the rabbi who was very good, you remember? And he insinuated...
Rabbi
that,
David, yes.
Yeah. He insinuated that some Jewish people, the young Jewish people, they don't think that Israel should exist. And I was a bit surprised because although I hate what they're doing in the Israel government and all that with Gaza, surely a reformed Israel should continue to exist. It was an odd thing, I thought, really. I wondered what he thought.
He wasn't insinuating, Norma. He was quoting from an opinion poll. And in that opinion poll, in that age group, 40% of those believed that Israel should not exist. Just like if you'd had an opinion poll in Britain in the Cold War, should the Soviet Union exist, you would have got a very large number of people voting that it should not. And that would have been a perfectly legitimate opinion. Just like in Scotland, if you were to ask in an opinion poll tomorrow, should the United Kingdom continue to exist, you'd get a very large number of people saying no. States don't have a right to exist. States are a political construct which are here today and gone tomorrow. I love Czechoslovakia, but it no longer exists. States exist until they don't exist. What I think you're worried about is any inference that this means the people in that country should not exist. But of course, that's not at all true. If Scotland left the United Kingdom, the people in England and Wales would continue to exist. It just wouldn't be the United Kingdom anymore. Just like when the Czechs and the Slovaks broke up, the people continued to exist. They just were no longer Czechoslovakians. Last word to you, Norma.
Yeah, I realise that. But I suppose inside of me, I thought, well, Israel has, it is a state now, and it's not allied to another one like we are in England, Scotland and Wales, or the Czechs and the Slovaks. And I just thought, well, they still need to be there. Awful that they are. I didn't quite get what you
Well,
mean.
I think the best solution would be for a state of Israel hyphen Palestine to exist. One state with one vote for every man and woman, Muslim, Christian or Jew, living under a constitution guaranteeing the rights of all. That would be the best way to get out of this jam that we are in. And as I've said, I would call it the Holy Land. I drop the Israel hyphen Palestine and call it the Holy Land of Israel hyphen Palestine. That would be the best solution. But people say, well, what about the two-state solution? I say, what about it? Put it on the table. Let me see it. Produce it. Let's see if it works. But I've got to tell you, Norma, the vast majority of people who say they want a two-state solution are quite confident that no such two-state solution will ever appear. And so I feel very bitter, having genuinely supported the Oslo Agreement and the two-state solution for now more than 30 years, that we were all hoodwinked, that it was all sand thrown in our eyes. Sorry, I've got to cut you off, Norma, because as you can tell, I'm now 5 whole minutes after the witching hour, and that's going to cost me plenty. All I can do is thank Norma for that last call and all the callers who didn't get through, hundreds of them. I want to thank the 50,542 people who voted in our poll. And I want to thank each and every one of you for watching and sharing this material. Please do share it. When you see the clips, share them. When you see the stream on YouTube, please share it. 3 million last week. Let's make it 3 million again, shall we? For the mother of all talk shows. See you on Wednesday, 7 p.m. UK time from London.